Settlement to Superpower, Introduction, Episode 2, The Protagonists. So, hello everybody, and welcome back to From Settlement to Superpower. Last episode, we discussed the various factors and events which led up to the English Reformation. We identified then three of the major forces which will influence the attitudes of the people once the Reformation actually gets going. As you'll recall, these forces consisted of a long and deeply held anti-clericalism for the general populace, Lutheran theology filtering over from the continent for the more academically inclined, and the question of papal versus royal supremacy for King Henry himself. Today we will begin to tell that tale. It is a tale of lust, of nobility, of faith, and of folly. It is a tale that can be colored in neither black nor white, but rather various shades of gray. It is the tale of the Henrician Reformation. But first, we need to introduce our dramatis personae for Act 1, Scene 1 of this cosmic comedy. They are King Henry VIII, his wife, Queen Catherine of Aragon, his sweetheart, Anne Boleyn, and yes, I know that the way to pronounce the name is Boleyn, and not as I said it last week, Boleyn, and the king's longtime confidant and minister, Thomas Wolsey. Now, I know that I said last week that our introductory episodes should last no longer than 5 episodes. Well, what do you know? I was wrong. There's just so much information we need to go through if we wish to properly understand the history of America, and I just can't bring myself to treat this introductory material superficially. You see, history in my eyes is more than just a dry compendium of dates, events, and places. History is a living and passionate story, and we must understand the philosophical makeup and mentality of those whose actions we study, at least if we hope to appreciate this magnificent tapestry, which is the history of the American Republic. As such, I am just as committed to fairly describing the prologue to our story as I am to describing our story itself, and therefore, I am pretty sure that it will take at least another 3 episodes, making a total of 8, before we can get to the Virginia Charter. Now, I'm as anxious as anybody to get to the founding of Jamestown. Therefore, I hope to put out these introductory episodes about the English Reformation and England on the eve of colonization faster than my stated pace of 1 podcast a week. So, although I am increasing the projected number of episodes until we get to episode 1.1, I am also speeding up my research and production, so hopefully it should be roughly the same amount of time before our story truly begins, something like 5 weeks. Anyways, if you've got any feedback or comments about this change, or for that matter about any of my podcast content, by all means let me know, either in the comments at fromsettlementtosuperpower.com or via email at fromsettlementtosuperpower@gmail.com. Okay, done with that. On to the podcast. King Henry VIII was born on the 28th of June 1491, the second surviving son of his parents, King Henry VII of England and Queen Elizabeth of York. Because young Henry was not the intended heir to the English throne, a right held by his older brother Arthur, we don't know all that much about his early childhood. We do know, however, that he was originally destined for a life in the clergy, and was given a top-notch education, his primary tutor being a man he would later cruelly behead, a world-famous scholar by the name of Thomas More. Prince Henry excelled in all of his studies, and was considered something of a child prodigy. When he was but 8 years old, Thomas More brought the famous humanist Erasmus of Rotterdam to visit his royal wards. Prince Henry, who had always possessed a quick and inquisitive mind, decided to keep up a correspondence with the famed scholar, and did so in the form of several letters written in flawless Latin. Erasmus was sure that the 8-year-old was writing these letters with the assistance of his tutors, and was most astounded and impressed when he found out that the young prince had written them entirely on his own. By the time he actually ascended to the throne at age 18, Henry was considered an almost perfect prince. He was a brilliant scholar, and was proficient in an astounding range of philosophical and scientific disciplines, from theology and languages to engineering, mathematics, and astronomy. He was by all accounts quite handsome, played the lute and harpsichord, had a strong singing voice, and exceeded his peers in such physical exercises as wrestling, jousting, and tennis. His old correspondent Erasmus referred to him as a universal genius, who possessed a lively mentality which reached for the stars, and he was able beyond measure to bring to perfection whatever task he undertook. That such a phenomenally talented king would be remembered primarily as a bloodthirsty tyrant who delighted in executions and had 6 wives, is in fact one of the greatest tragedies of Tudor England. That Henry's reign didn't unfold quite as brilliantly as so many men of learning expected must be attributed to the darker side of Henry's nature, the side which this episode has hitherto ignored. Henry was a man controlled not by his learning, but by his passion. He was arrogant and willful to the extreme. Winston Churchill writes that Henry was the nightmare of his advisers. Once a scheme was fixed in his mind, he could seldom be turned from it. Resistance only made him more stubborn, and once embarked, he always tended to go too far unless restrained. The only secret to managing him, both Wolsey and Cromwell disclosed after they had fallen, was to see that dangerous ideas were not permitted to reach him. The problem with this strategy, however, was that the king perceived himself to be a king of the people, and would constantly just stop random commoners to hear what they had to say. So you'd have the king attentively listening to what Baldric the Dung Sweeper has to say, and if he was momentarily impressed by Baldric's idea, then good luck to his advisors on getting that scheme out of his head. Henry also had an unstable disposition, at one moment appearing jovial and friendly, and at the next exploding in uncontrollable rage. Combined with his arrogant sensitivities and willful nature, this was a truly frightening personality cocktail. He also had an inordinate sensual passion, and he employed all of these above fearsome personality traits in getting what he wanted. Henry's final flaw, which we'll discuss here, was his utter lack of anything even remotely resembling effective stewardship. Henry was a wastrel in every sense of the word, spending precious crowns on extravagant building projects and grandiose military campaigns, virtually all of which ended in failure. Henry struggled throughout his reign with the finances of the realm, which led him to eventually dissolve the monasteries and take all their money and lands for himself. Anyways, following his brother's death, Henry was betrothed to his brother's widow, Catherine of Aragon. As we mentioned last episode, the marriage was arranged shortly after Arthur's death. However, Henry didn't actually marry Catherine until he ascended to the throne. As we will discuss later, the reason for this was because King Henry VII had fallen out with Spain and no longer cared for the union. However, upon his father's death and his own ascension to the throne, one of the first decisions Henry VIII made was to marry Catherine. That makes now as good of a time as any to leave off talking about Henry for some time, fascinating figure though he may be, and to cover the events of his early reign through the lens of our 3 other introductions, those of Catherine, Wolsey, and Anne Boleyn. We mentioned last episode how Catherine was betrothed to the young Prince Henry in 1503, following the death of Henry's older brother, Crown Prince Arthur. However, following Queen Isabella of Castile's death in 1504, King Henry VII felt that Catherine was no longer as good a match for the future King of England as she once was, and as such he compelled his son, Prince Henry, to declare that he rejected Catherine and no longer wished to marry her. Undaunted, however, Catherine stayed in England despite the broken betrothal, behind the cover of being her father's ambassador to England. Catherine adored Henry and was determined to marry him no matter what. And truth to be told, Catherine was an excellent match for young Henry. She was, in old Erasmus's words, again, miraculously learned for a woman. She was an expert Latinist and an accomplished scholar. Throughout her life, she was considered something of a patron of the arts, generously funding artistic endeavors and humanist learning. She was also a beautiful and serene young woman, and carried herself with an air of dignity and amicability which so rarely come together in one. And so it was that Henry VIII decided to marry Catherine in 1509. Henry had always liked her, and had only renounced her earlier on the strong insistence of his father. He had, in fact, written years back to King Ferdinand of Aragon, telling him that if he were still free, he would choose her for a wife before all others. Well, now he was free, and now he chose her before all others. Their marriage was for many years a happy one, with the king and queen sharing a love for stimulating discussions and music. They would often read together in Henry's library, and were both unusually devoted to each other for members of their class and age. She would often refer to the king as my Henry, and he reciprocated by writing her love poetry. As the holly groweth green and never changeth hue, so I am, e'er hath been, unto my lady true. Of course, we should not take Henry too literally here. Although he undeniably was deeply in love with Catherine, he was still known to carry on affairs with multiple women in his court. It's one of those later affairs, in fact, which will upend Henry's hitherto peaceful domestic life. But we're jumping ahead here. Having introduced Catherine, it's time to meet the man who will star in this episode, the man we've mentioned multiple times in the previous episode, Thomas Wolsey. Thomas Wolsey was born in 1473 to humble origins in Ipswich. There are conflicting accounts of his father's profession, and from what I've seen, his father was either a butcher or a wool merchant, but regardless of which of the two it was a pretty lowly start. But young Thomas displayed unusual precocity and was sent off to study in Oxford, where he developed into a brilliant young man, graduating at only 15 years of age. Wolsey joined the clergy and enjoyed a meteoric rise through the ranks, becoming, in 1507, the personal chaplain to King Henry VII. Henry VIII, always distrustful of the old blood nobility who surrounded him, saw in this ambitious and indefatigable man great promise. Henry rapidly advanced Wolsey's career, giving him numerous administrative and ecclesiastical duties and making him the unofficial royal secretary. By 1511, Wolsey had been promoted to the Privy Council. Thomas Wolsey was a proud and extremely driven individual, possessed of a single-minded ambition to climb the greased pole of wealth and royal favor. His industriousness, combined with his considerable administrative and diplomatic talents, made him into a titanic force, both in the Privy Council and on the international arena. Wolsey kept up an almost superhuman schedule, rising at 4 a.m. daily, and sitting at his desk working for something like 14 hours straight, not stopping for food, the bathroom, anything. He took on the workload of 10 men, and through it all performed magnificently. Thomas Wolsey was a statesman for the ages, and I cannot think of a single other statesman to match Wolsey in his combination of industry and talent. Wolsey's great chance came in the year 1512, with the outbreak of war between England and France. We're not going to deal with the labyrinthine intricacies of the diplomatic situation on the continent, but it is sufficient for our purposes to understand that the era was defined by rivalry and intermittent warfare between the French House of Valois and the Holy Roman Empire under the Habsburgs. Throughout his reign, Henry's foreign policy revolved around playing the two powers against one another for England's benefit. Initially, Wolsey, along with the King's Lord Chancellor, Archbishop William Warham, was opposed to initiating any sort of war with the Continental Powers, considering it a pointless waste of funds, and preferring instead to shore up England's treasury and domestic infrastructure. But then he noticed in 1511 how dead set the king was on establishing himself a reputation as a martial colossus, and Wolsey conveniently shifted his own position to closer match the king's. When the war did break out, Wolsey proved himself to be a wizard of finance and organization, and it was thanks solely to his own unflagging industriousness that the English armies were provisioned and kept in the field for the duration of the war. And when, in 1514, Henry's faithless allies formed a separate peace with France, thus leaving England in the awkward position of having to negotiate their own peace with France, Wolsey showed his mastery of the diplomatic arts. Despite England's disadvantaged position, Wolsey managed to extricate England with an honorable peace. In gratitude for Wolsey's indispensable services provided throughout the war, the king forced Archbishop Warham to resign and installed Wolsey as his new Lord Chancellor. In addition to occasioning Wolsey's rise to the top, there was another event which occurred over the course of the war, which I'd like to digress and discuss, both as a result of the occasion itself, as well as the occasion's aftermath. The event I am referring to is the Battle of Flodden Field. In 1513, James IV of Scotland crossed the River Tweed into England with a force of 40,000 men, in an invasion designed to relieve the beleaguered French, who were longtime allies of the Scots. Catherine of Aragon, who was acting as regent until Henry would return from France, mustered up an army 26,000 strong, under an old soldier in his 70s, Thomas Howard, the Earl of Surrey. Before the Tudors took the English crown at Bosworth Field, the Howards had held the Dukedom of Norfolk, which was the most powerful dukedom in all of England. However, upon the Tudor ascension, the dukedom was revoked as a punishment to the Howards for having supported King Richard III, and thereupon the Howards styled themselves not as the Dukes of Norfolk, but rather as the Earls of Surrey. We're going to keep our eyes on the Howards, because they're going to have quite a role to play in events yet to come. In any event, Surrey marched his troops up north to meet the Scots, Catherine having sent them off with a rousing speech, and placed himself and his forces between the Scottish army and Edinburgh. The Scots were forced to fight, and the two armies squared off at Flodden Moor, in the province of Northumberland. This was the largest battle, numerically speaking, ever fought between the English and the Scots, and was probably the most significant as well, with the only possible exception in my mind being Brunanburh back in 937. Anyways, the battle was a smashing victory for the English. The Scots formed up in their traditional skiltron formation, ready to strike at the English army. Recklessly, however, the Scots abandoned their position on the high ground to destroy the English forces, who then tore up their advancing lines with cannon fire and their dreaded longbow. when the lines met in hand-to-hand melee, the English utterly decimated the Scottish army. The reason for this great disparity was because the Scots were armed with clumsy, long, and cumbersome pikes, whereas the English had much shorter and much more manageable handbills and axes. The coup de grace came with the English cavalry's charge into the Scottish flank, which ended up chain routing the entire Scottish army. The human cost for Scotland was appalling. King James himself was slain in the thick of the fighting, along with virtually all of the Scottish nobility and somewhere about 12,000 men. Scotland would be plunged into a chaotic regency and would never recover, and this was the last time the Scots would pose a serious threat to England, excepting, of course, the events of the English Civil War. Now that's all interesting enough in and of itself, but the really relevant result of this battle was that the grateful King Henry VIII restored to the old Howard his family's hold on the Dukedom of Norfolk. Old Thomas Howard would die in the year 1514, and his son, also named Thomas Howard, although we will of course simply refer to him as Norfolk, will be a pretty major player for some time to come. But let's get back to our good friend Thomas Wolsey. We must not forget that for all of Wolsey's achievements in the secular arenas of royal administration and diplomacy, he was still ultimately a member of the clergy. As a matter of fact, not only was he a member of the clergy, but in England he was more or less the member of the clergy. You see, the papacy was always eager to shore up relations with the secular powers of Christendom, and when the Pope heard that an accomplished clergyman, Thomas Wolsey, was now Lord Chancellor of England, he pretty much immediately appointed Wolsey Cardinal. His rise continued, and by 1518 he was the papal legate to England. Now, we're not going to concern ourselves over much with Wolsey's various diplomatic feats over the next decade, but suffice it to say that they were all highly successful. All that is, with the exception of two, which we will relate soon. In any event, Wolsey would spend the next decade accumulating more and more power and prestige for himself, and set about neutralizing his enemies, at times quite ruthlessly. You see, Wolsey was a man with many enemies. As a matter of fact, just about everybody in England except for the king himself could be counted as an enemy of Wolsey. The hereditary nobles despised him as a power-hungry upstart, and even the lower-born courtiers of King Henry despised him as an arrogant, extravagant, and domineering hypocrite. The local clergy and the pious Queen Catherine weren't all too fond of Wolsey either. Despite his legendary administrative and diplomatic exploits, Wolsey was neither pious nor diligent in his pastoral duties, and was far more interested in using the church offices as its source of political clout and personal enrichment than he was in ministering to the people's spiritual needs. From 1514, when he was granted Warham's Archbishopric of York, until 1529, when he fell from royal favor, he visited his diocese, you guessed it, exactly never. That's right, never. Wolsey was the absentee priest par excellence. It didn't either help Wolsey that it was common knowledge that he held a mistress. Wolsey, however, proved to be more than adequate a match for his rivals, and he effectively neutralized or eclipsed them one by one. Let's look at two of his contemporaries, and the different strategies with which he dealt with them. This should give us an idea of Wolsey's power and ruthlessness. The first of these contemporaries was Charles Brandon, the Duke of Suffolk. Suffolk was granted his dukedom at the same time as old Norfolk was, in reward for his services to the war effort in France. Suffolk was a fast friend of Wolsey at the time, but Wolsey correctly ascertained that in the cutthroat world of the royal court, friendship was not enough. Suffolk would have to either become a client of Wolsey's, or else be eliminated. As it turned out, Wolsey got his chance soon enough. You see, back in the Tudor period, the nobility seldom, if ever, married for love. They married instead for opportunity, with a dynastic marriage being one of the strongest diplomatic moves in the book. As such, when Wolsey negotiated the peace between Henry and King Louis XII of France, he included therein a royal marriage between the Princess Mary, King Henry's sister, and King Louis of France, who was over 30 years older than she was. The well-known anecdote relates that Mary told the king that she only agreed to marry for duty this once, and her subsequent marriages would be for love, and for love only. Anyways, turns out that Mary lucked out, because King Louis of France died only 2.5 months after they married. Mary was now open, and she knew exactly whom she wished to marry next. The lucky man, of course, was Suffolk, with whom Mary had been in love with even before Wolsey carted her off to France. The only problem was that aside from the two lovers, there was literally nobody in England who wanted the pair of them to marry. The nobles on the Privy Council were opposed because they feared being eclipsed by Suffolk, who would become the king's brother-in-law. Norfolk in particular was vehemently opposed to such a marriage because he absolutely despised Suffolk, both because he considered Suffolk to be his inferior in pedigree, as well as because Suffolk was granted by Henry the position of Earl Marshal, which was a position traditionally held by the Howards. King Henry and Wolsey were opposed as well, despite the fact that they both very much liked Suffolk, for the usual reasons of statecraft, that is, because they wanted Princess Mary's second marriage to bring advantage to the realm, in a way that marriage to Suffolk could not possibly provide. And so it was, when Henry sent Suffolk over to France to retrieve the now widowed Princess Mary and to congratulate the newly crowned King Francis I, he made Suffolk promise not to propose to Mary. Suffolk dutifully promised, and, what do you know, was convinced by Mary over in France to marry her right then and there. The pair got married in a secret ceremony with only 10 men present, one of whom was King Francis himself, who was delighted that Henry was losing this valuable diplomatic asset. When the news of what had occurred trickled back to the king via Wolsey, he and the rest of the Privy Council flew into a towering rage. The council demanded that Suffolk be executed for treason, and Henry would have probably acceded to their demand had not Wolsey stepped into the picture. Wolsey, moved by his genuine affection for Suffolk as well as the fact that he had a golden opportunity before him, interceded with the king and convinced him to disregard his other counselors and let Suffolk off the hook with merely a heavy fine, which the king did. Thus, in one shrewd stroke, Wolsey parried his rival's bid to make themselves more powerful by dividing up Suffolk's titles and wealth, had effectively turned the powerful Suffolk into a client of his, as well as ensured that Suffolk would go into semi-retirement where he'd pose no threat, a state in which he would remain for over a decade. But behind Wolsey's silk glove, there was cold iron. This is demonstrated most of all by how he dealt with his most implacable rival amongst the nobility, Edward Stafford, cousin of the king and the Duke of Buckingham. Buckingham was, like the Tudors, descended from the old ruling Plantagenet dynasty, and the arrogant and blue-blooded noble bitterly loathed the common upstart Wolsey, and pretty much everything Wolsey supported, as a matter of principle, Buckingham opposed. The feeling was mutual, and in one delicious episode, Buckingham was holding the washbasin in which the king dipped his fingers during the meal. Wolsey had the temerity to then wash his own fingers in the same basin as the king had, and the infuriated Buckingham responded by dumping the dirty water over Wolsey's expensive shoes, thus provoking a very noisy and very public altercation between the two. It was quite clear to Wolsey that Buckingham could never be brought over, and so he needed to be eliminated. By 1520, Wolsey had begun planting spies and interrogating servants of Buckingham, searching for evidence that Buckingham was a traitor, working to seize the crown for himself. Wolsey began by planting suspicions in the king's mind, turning every routine action Buckingham took into potentially treasonous activity. When the paranoid king began to buy into all this, Wolsey got to work finding disaffected officers among Buckingham's staff who would be eager to say anything the all-powerful Wolsey told them to. He also, on the basis of mere hearsay, put several of Buckingham's servants to torture in order to force out from them spurious confessions and admissions of their master's guilt. By 1521, the king was fully convinced and had Buckingham imprisoned on charges of treason and plotted regicide. The unfortunate Buckingham was hauled before a jury of his peers, who knew that they had little choice but to rubber stamp the verdict Wolsey had already persuaded the king of. A sham trial proceeded, during the course of which Buckingham was refused the right to cross-examine the witnesses brought against him, after which a weeping Norfolk read out the verdict and sentence: guilty and execution by beheading. 4 days later, the sentence was carried out, Buckingham keeping his dignity to the last. Now, I know that there are some historians who try to make the case that Buckingham was, in fact, guilty of treason, or that Wolsey was not behind Stafford's downfall. Nonetheless, I throw my lot in with those who believe that Wolsey's machinations were planned to bring about his rival's elimination. This view, as a matter of fact, was the view accepted by virtually everybody back then, with the Holy Roman Emperor and King of Spain Charles V declaring that a butcher's dog has killed the finest buck in all England. After this, it was clear to all that there was no power in England save that of Wolsey, and all his rivals could do was privately fume and fulminate. He held the exchequer, he held the church, he held basically every position of administrative importance in the land, and most importantly, he held the king's full and unwavering confidence. Everyone knew, but nobody dared to say what the Venetian envoy reported back home. The cardinal is king, nor does his majesty depart in the least from the opinion and counsel of his lordship. This situation continued until 1525, when Wolsey made a catastrophic mistake, the first of his two failures I alluded to earlier. To make a long story short, Henry was once again at war with France, together with the Holy Roman Emperor. The war had not been going well for the English, and Wolsey suggested that the king open up private overtures for peace with Francis I. The king followed Wolsey's advice, but this turned out to be a really bad move. Within a few months, the French army was utterly annihilated by the Holy Roman Empire at the Battle of Pavia, with King Francis himself, along with virtually all his nobles who weren't slain in the fighting, captured by the triumphant imperial forces. The Holy Roman Empire had won the war, and France was at their mercy. But Henry didn't get to share in the spoils and glory of triumph. Charles V, infuriated by Henry's lack of good faith, froze England out of the peace negotiations, and to add insult to injury, decided to cancel his planned marriage to a Tudor princess, and instead went ahead and married a Portuguese princess. Henry was enraged, and Wolsey was the only man responsible for this mess. Although Wolsey would retain his positions, he no longer commanded the absolute and unquestioning confidence of the king, and it was definitely clear that he was no longer unchallengeable. If one listens closely at this point in time, one can hear the long knives being unsheathed and sharpened in the Privy Council. They will not strike for another 4 years yet, but they are being prepared. In that same year, a chain of unforeseen events began. A chain which would come to shake the bedrock of all England, and lead to the second most catastrophic mistake of Wolsey's. It all began naturally enough, when Henry found himself a new amour. Henry had since grown sick of Catherine, and his poorly restrained passions were aroused by a 25-year-old woman by the name of Anne Boleyn. Anne was the daughter of Thomas Boleyn and Lady Elizabeth Howard, sister of our good friend Norfolk. She was charming and ambitious, had a fiery temper and razor-sharp tongue, and was well-trained in the art of courtly love. She also, it should be pointed out, utterly despised Cardinal Wolsey, who had used his power to break not one, but two of Anne's previous engagements. As it turned out, Anne was the one enemy Wolsey couldn't afford to have. The king vigorously pursued Anne, even ennobling her father, turning him into Viscount Lisle. But she, being a master temptress, played the king like a fiddle. She'd tease him, show signs of affection, and then just when the king thought he would have her, she'd withdraw from the court and retire to the countryside for several weeks. Henry was driven nearly mad by this, and his steamy hot love letters betray a most frantic desire for Anne to give herself up to him, body and soul. Anne, it could be said, shrewdly realized and capitalized on that timeless truth that an object in possession seldom carries the same charge it did in pursuit. She made it quite clear to Henry that while she would always be his in affection, she would not be his in body until she was his lawfully wedded queen. This, it should be noted, was not chastity on her part. She was simply leveraging the king's desire for a male heir combined with his infatuation for her in order to further the fortunes of both herself and her family. And so it was, in 1527, Henry decided to annul his marriage with Catherine and marry Anne. We leave off this episode precisely where we left off last week's episode, with Henry's decision to annul his marriage with Catherine and to marry Anne. Next episode, we will move on in the story. That, I promise you. I'll see you then.